Good morning. We're delighted to welcome students from Monticello High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court of Wisconsin and the State Bar. And with this program, we invite students from across the state to join us for an oral argument. And if the students agree to come, then they're provided with material relating to this oral argument. They come, and at noon, after the second oral argument, they are joined by a justice of this court to discuss the procedures of the court in taking cases and in deciding cases. The students do not discuss with the justice the substantive issues in the case. So we're delighted to welcome Monticello High School, and at 1:30, Wauwatosa West High School will appear, but I think they will be joining the students for the discussion at noon. Everyone is invited to come to the discussion after this case. It is not limited to the students. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. It's easier to listen to the oral argument if you have an understanding of the facts and the legal issues presented. Would anyone like a summary? I raised my hand, but I do have a summary already, so I don't need another copy. Let me introduce the court to all of you. On my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice assigned today to meet with you after this case. Seated to the left of Justice Crooks is Justice Patience Rogensack, and to her left is Justice Michael Gableman. Starting at the other end of the court, to my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler, and seated next to her is Justice David Prosser, and to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With those introductions made, I'm going to call our second case for today. 08AP3135, Society Insurance versus Lerp. Our lineup is as follows. 25 minutes for Assistant Attorney General David Hart. 25 minutes for James Goonan, who represents the Society Insurance. And 5 minutes for James Friedman, who represents the Amicus Wisconsin Insurance Alliance, and then 5 minutes for Mr. Hart. Is that correct? All right. And that's what we're going to do. David A. Hart III, Assistant Attorney General, representing LIRC. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. As the Chief Justice pointed out, I am Assistant Attorney General David Hart, and I represent the Wisconsin Workers Injury Supplemental Benefit Fund, or the Fund. And the Fund believes that the trial court's decision and the trial court's decision should be reversed, and the commission's decision should be affirmed for two reasons. First, because 10217 sub 4 requires Society Insurance to pay for Gary Liska's medical treatment expenses that become due more than 12 years after his original date of injury. And secondly, requiring Society Insurance to pay for these expenses does not violate, rather than the fund, doesn't violate Society Insurance's due process or contractual constitutional rights.
If I can just interrupt you quickly. It's my understanding that there's agreement between the parties that 10217 sub 4 and the other provision, 10266.1, they're retroactive.
That is correct, Your Honor.
and that they are, by express language, apply to this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that it's agreed that society's obligation under the old law ended prior to the enactment of this law.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's agreed.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're presenting really a pure legal question of the constitutionality of the retroactive application of the new 1966 statute that imposed liability on society.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, would the court like a brief recitation of the facts or a recitation briefly on how the fund works and what it is?
Well, why don't you do it very briefly, because I don't know that either will affect the ultimate determination.
Yes,
but if you think it does, of course, you're in charge.
Yes, Your Honor. Just very briefly, in June of 1982, Gary Liska suffered a work-related right leg injury that resulted in the loss of his right leg below the knee. Liska received workers' compensation benefits from his employer, James Meyer, and his benefits, Mr. Liska's benefits, would have expired in 2002, would it not have been for the underlying statutes in dispute. In 2004, the fund began paying for Mr. Liska's medical treatment expenses after he filed an application for benefits.
Right, so he got benefits after 2002.
Yes, Your Honor, he did.
But society wasn't going to pay.
Yes, Your Honor.
The fund was going to pay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The fund did, in fact, pay. In 2006, pursuant to the amended statute at issue, the fund sent Society Insurance a letter indicating that it would no longer be responsible for or paying for Mr. Liska's medical treatment expenses, that Society Insurance would be responsible pursuant to 10217 sub 4. Now, just very quickly, there are four distinct programs that the fund funds. First, the second injury fund. The actual fund pays benefits to seriously injured workers who have pre-existing disabilities. For instance, if a worker in 1988 injures his right arm or has his right arm cut off, and then in 2002 that same worker injures his left arm or his left hand, the fund would pay a certain amount of benefits to this worker, but also the underlying insurance company would pay benefits as well. The second kind of the second fund that the fund provides benefits for is the children's fund, and this, simply put, provides benefits to children who have parents that have been fatally injured in work accidents. Usually, the benefits are paid to children until they're 18. The third kind is the supplemental benefits fund, and that essentially provides a cost of living benefit for workers who have been permanently and totally disabled or who are on temporary disability for more than 2 years. And then, of course, the barred occupational or specific traumatic claims, which is the case, which is involves the case at bar. An example of this, the occupational piece. If a worker has been working for a foundry and develops silicosis after 35 years of work, and his last date of work is 1983, and then it becomes disabled in 2009 because of that injury, we, as the fund, pay that claim. Another example, a specific traumatic claim. If a worker in 1975 injures his or her knee and has a knee replacement, but in 2009 his doctor or her doctor calls for another knee surgery or a knee replacement, as the law sits currently, the underlying insurance company would pay for that medical expense.
And we agree that here, under the old law, society was free of any obligations for the traumatic injury.
Under the 2003 4 and 5, that particular act, absolutely, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. Counsel, where does it stop then? This is one of the sticking points I'm going to have with your argument.
Yes.
When people decide they're going to buy insurance or they're going to buy something, they pay a premium knowing here's your begin date, here's your end date, here's our cap, here's our liability, here's what you're getting. And it seems to me that this really opens that up. How do people know how to contract for things? How do people know when their liability stops? How far back could this go? If instead of 2002 it was 2000, would it still be something where you'd feel you can go back and apply retroactively?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does it stop?
I'm sorry.
I'll stop now.
Well, Your Honor, we understand that, as the fund, we understand that there is great care that needs to be placed in thought when we're impairing contractual rights. And we understand that this is an impairment of a contractual right. Clearly, society relied on being able to not have these sort of obligations after the 12-year statute of limitation had run. However, we assert that the floodgates here won't open, that this only involves a small number of cases, and what's more, society can adjust for the future and raise premium rates today going forward, if that were the case or if that were an issue.
It's a small quantity of cases. Why?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why is it a small quantity of cases that are possible?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, because the case at issue is a specific traumatic injury dealing with a knee replacement or treatment expenses related to those sort of things. We don't have a lot of those cases currently at issue.
Mr. Hart?
Yes, sir.
You carefully give us the facts.
Yes, Your Honor.
Of the injury here.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the record is devoid of any other facts.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because the administrative law judge and the NLRC did not look at the constitutional issue, and they didn't do it because under a series of our cases, the administrative agency is a legislative created body. It belongs to the legislative branch of government, and they can't bite the hand that fed them, right? They cannot declare a legislative enactment unconstitutional, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that is in essence true.
So we now get to circuit court.
Yes.
And the issue is not any of the facts you've given us, except everybody accepts that the guy had surgery, lost a part of a leg, and that fits under the traumatic exception.
Yes,
right?
Your Honor.
We all agree on that. The trial court, did it take testimony?
It did not.
It did not. Is it authorized to take evidence?
Of course it is, Your Honor.
It's authorized to take evidence, even in a review of an administrative agency.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. So, how do we know as a court how substantial an impairment of a contract is when there's no evidence? How do we know what the purpose of this retroactive provision is? It's not in the statute. It's even hard to guess because if I understood your brief, the supposition is solvency.
Yes, Your Honor.
But when you look at the legislative history, there's no reference to solvency. So it's hard to find that the fund is going insolvent and they have to reduce their liabilities. There's nothing in there. And yet, both impairment of contractual right and due process is, simply put, a balancing. You balance the rights of society, which is protected by a kind of statute of limitations, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Therefore, it has expectations imposed by statute, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. And you balance those rights against a public purpose, right?
Yes.
And the greater the right, the greater the public purpose. The less substantial impairment, then the less important the public purpose, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What in the record tells us anything about how to make that balance?
Your Honor, the court is absolutely correct that the record is sparse. The trial court had every opportunity.
The record is sitting right here in front of us. This is the whole record.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The trial court had every opportunity to take evidence. We asked the court, and Society Insurance asked the court to remand this for further evidence gathering. And the trial court said, I don't need it. The court makes the determination that this is an unconstitutional statute and struck the statute down. Now, the court has pointed out the multi-part test that this court has set forth to determine whether a constitutional statute is constitutional or not. We know that it, first of all, that it is Society Insurance's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that, first of all, that there is a substantial impairment to them.
Now, it's their burden to show the statute is unconstitutional.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
So they have the absolute burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to illustrate that every element that you've set forth in this test. First, we have to ask whether there's a substantial impairment. And they have not illustrated that there is a substantial impairment. We don't have, the fund doesn't have an opinion on what would meet a substantial impairment. We believe that whether this court finds there's a substantial impairment or not, that this statute is constitutional. But the first step is to determine whether there's a substantial impairment.
Well, the trial court said, well, it's 14 grand here, but you multiply that by the number of insurance companies out there, so you get a lot of money.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that a good way of doing it?
Well, Your Honor, the trouble with the trial court's analysis is that he used speculation and conjecture to determine that there was a substantial burden, and impairment placed on Society Insurance. Now, when a moving party has the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, they can't speculate and conjecture. Now, the fund is able to use speculation and conjecture because under Chappie versus Lurk, the court says that if there's any reasonable basis that the statute's constitutionality may rest, the court must assume that the legislature had that fact in mind when the statute was passed.
But could I add?
Go ahead, Justice Prosser.
What is included in traumatic injury?
Any injury, currently any injury that has a specific end, a beginning and end, so that there's, an occupational would be an injury that occurred over a period of time, so a back injury that was developed over, some repetitive motion or silicosis, lung disease, that sort of thing.
I thought you used an example of silicosis. Was that
for an occupational?
For an occupational.
Disease. Yes, Your Honor.
So it's any sort of like a sudden loss of a limb or something.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Which is what's involved in this case.
Yes.
But shouldn't the court factor into its consideration every traumatic injury and how that might affect all the insurers as a result of the change in the law?
If I understand the court, the justice's question correctly, that shouldn't all traumatic injuries be in the calculus of this particular decision?
Not only that, but all insurance companies.
In other words, in a particular case, we might be talking about 5,000 or 14,000 or a relatively modest amount of money. you couldn't really have a different rule of law, could you, if the result were $200,000?
If, again, if I understand the court's question correctly, that that because this is $14,000, this is a fairly minimal amount.
I mean, society insurance will probably survive $14,000, $15,000. If you have a potentially unlimited number of $200,000, $300,000 damage implications because of going back in time, that's a different story.
Well, Your Honor, perhaps it is a different story, but again, this is society's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it would suffer a substantial impairment, and it has not illustrated that to date.
Counsel, I need to follow up on what Justice Prosser is saying, and it also goes back to your answer to my question before. Are you saying that in order to rise to a constitutional question, there must be a certain amount of people that are affected or a dollar amount that's affected? I mean, can't it be a constitutional question even if it only affects one person or one entity?
Absolutely. Again, the fund doesn't take a position on whether or not there is a substantial impairment here. We believe that this statute survives whether there's a substantial impairment to society or not. We believe that the justice is absolutely correct, that even if there is one individual that's harmed or $1, that there's the potential for that to be a substantial impairment, but there has been no illustration by society insurance. It's their burden to illustrate that they have been substantially burdened by this or there's a substantial impairment.
But you have two facts. One, what is the nature of the burden? And
yes, sir.
Two, what is the nature of the public purpose?
Yes, sir.
The greater the burden, the higher the purpose.
Yes, sir.
The more compelling the purpose. The lower the burden, the less compelling the purpose. So your position is it may be a substantial burden, but it's not proved.
Yes, Your Honor. The fund does not take a position on, again, whether or not it's a substantial impairment. But that's the first piece of the test.
Now, you say you asked for putting in evidence, and that, if I heard you right, and that the Society Insurance asked the trial court to let him put in evidence?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. Society Insurance asked for a remand at the trial court level.
At the trial court level, right. Okay. Do you think it was error for the trial court to deny that? Especially in light of your reply brief, I think, which says, hey, remand, and the Insurance Alliance brief says, hey, maybe this should be remanded, if I read that correctly.
Well, Your Honor, there are a number of things that we believe the trial court erred in when it decided this case. We believe that it could possibly have been remanded for further proceedings. We again believe that if a record is established more completely, that we will find that this statute is constitutional in any case. But I believe the court, even if it has a sparse record, can make a decision today, and that is our primary position, is that there is a burden of proof, that it is a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, that society insurance has not met that burden, that you know, once you determine whether there is a substantial impairment or not, then we move to the second piece.
Let's move to the second.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the purpose? What's the legislative purpose or policy here?
Your Honor, we believe that the legislature had, of course, the fund solvency in mind.
Where do you find that?
Well, Your Honor, I have several notes from the Workers' Compensation Advisory Committee. However, I don't want to present those today because it's, again, not in the record. But again, as Chappie versus Lurk indicates, That
legislative history, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
And of course, the court is free to take judicial notice of that. However, as Chappie versus Lurk points out, that if there's any reasonable basis that this court can glean that the legislature may have had in mind when it made this legislation, it's obligated to right. say that it actually had that in mind when making that legislation.
We can make it up.
Yes. I don't want to say you can make it up, but certainly.
But that's true, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. So is the only one that you can think of that we can use is solvency?
Well, Your Honor, it's not the only one that I can think of, but it is, in fact, what the what I believe and what the fund believes the legislature had in mind.
Okay. What did the trial court say about that?
Well, Your Honor, the trial court, of course, rebuffed that and said, again, speculated that it adds to society insurance's argument that because the fund needs solvency and because the fund would be at a deficit or the fund doesn't want this impact, that why would society insurance want that as an impact? And because of those reasons, it is a substantial impairment, and that's speculation. When society insurance has the burden of proving that there is a substantial impairment first, beyond a reasonable doubt, they can't rely on, and the court can't rely on for them, on speculation and conjecture. Chappie says that we can.
I thought the trial court went even further that says insolvency is not a good public policy.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely, the court did say that.
And said if it's really a solvency issue, that weighs against the state.
Yes, Your Honor, the court did say that. We have naturally disagree with that.
You do. All right. So what does the state want us to do?
Well, Your Honor, the fund wants this court to affirm the commission's decision, declare that this statute is constitutional, and, of course, naturally our fallback position is if the court does not affirm the commission's decision, then we ask that this court remand these proceedings back to Lurk for further evidence gathering.
Why would we send it back to Lurk? Lurk can't decide the constitutionality. It can take evidence. Why aren't we going to just send it back to the trial court?
Well, just again, as the court pointed out, it can't determine constitutionality, but Lurk in workers' compensation
right.
actions, they are the primary fact-finding
That's right.
body.
But the trial court can find fact, can take evidence over and above the administrative agency. That's my recollection.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, but you prefer it to go back to the administrative body.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, maybe, I don't know if your time's going to run out, and if it does, we can talk about this when you get back up. I'd like you to give me some other examples of times when the legislature has been able to essentially shift costs on the basis that an agency may be insolvent, to have the private sector fund really what the legislature said was an insolvent agency's responsibility. If you could come up with some examples, that might be helpful, because for me that's a tough one, especially in these economic times. Our government is having all sorts of financial problems, and if the legislature can just enact a statute to shift the cost to the private sector, that's a difficult nut to crack.
Your Honor, none come to mind. I can certainly review the case law at my table. I see that my time has expired. May I answer?
Yes, you may, counsel.
None come to mind, but I know that it's tempting for the court and for the society to want to declare that this statute is unconstitutional, but. We are not, the fund is not in a position to raise rates, to pass rates on, and to take a lesser hit than society insurance and the larger insurance world. If this statute is declared constitutional, there are any number, dozens of insurance companies who can pass this hit among themselves and ultimately pass a smaller amount of this increase along to the consumers. We don't have that same mechanism.
Okay. Thank you.
I suggest you might look at Chappie. The amounts were quite small, and I don't have enough notes here on Knoll, but Knoll, too, may be of assistance. The other thing is, it's not your position, is it, that every time there's been a contract violation or breach, that constitutes a violation of either the contract clause or due process?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. Your Honor, I thought to mention Chappie as well as, I believe, State versus Iller. But of course, those are the controlling pieces of the law, and I'm certain the court is well versed on those.
Thank you, counsel.
Sure.
Mr. Goonan, representing Society Insurance.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am James Goonan. I'm here respectfully on behalf of Society Insurance and James Meyer Incorporated. Just wanted to go over a couple important items factually and then move forward thereafter. The statute of limitations ran in 2002. The last indemnity payment, temporary total disability, was in 1990. Thereafter, all medical benefits and expenses were due and owing by fund, the Work Injury Supplemental Benefit Fund. It's important to note that in February 2004, Mr. Liska, on his own behalf, unrepresented, filed a hearing application with the Department of Workforce Development. He was seeking reimbursement of $14,000 in addition to a handful of dollars in terms of mileage. So at that point, we knew that the medical expenses were continuing and significant in $14,000. And at that point, the department, ALJ O'Malley, ordered the fund to reimburse the $14,000. It's also important to understand what the fund is and what the fund isn't. Opposing counsel explained a few different items of what the fund funds, if you will, but we need to know what it is. The fund, in essence, is a pool of money and a pool of money from all the insurance companies. What it's not, it's not a state organization, and it's not the Wisconsin taxpayer. It's funded from a number of different sources pursuant to 10265. And that lists administrative penalties, surcharges, death benefits, where the deceased worker has no surviving benefits, or dependents, rather. There's also a statute, 10249, that says an additional lump sum benefit specifically for the state fund, amputation injuries like this, dismemberment, and then double and treble damages for an injury when there's an illegally employed minor. It's also important to note that the same time that this statute was changed, April 1 of 06, a couple other statutes were also changed, and that is 10249, the lump sum death benefit, went from $10,000 to $20,000. It was doubled. Similarly, with the amputation, the dismemberment statute, 10259, the moment that someone has a dismemberment or a traumatic injury like Mr. Lista did, it went from $10,000 to $20,000. So, in essence, what the fund did, or what the legislature did, rather, is they determined it went from 10 to 20, and they doubled it, and that was a tax, if you will, or a surcharge or an assessment on every insurance carrier throughout the state.
Now, that was what the advisory council agreed to, isn't it?
I believe so, yes, ma'am.
Okay. So they increased the amounts to be paid out, potentially, from the fund, maybe? Is that what you're telling us?
I'm sorry?
Did they increase, did the legislature, with the consent, with the advice of the advisory council, increase the amount to be paid out of the fund?
These are monies paid into the fund.
Ah, okay. Did they increase the monies out of the fund?
Not to my knowledge.
Was the fund in danger of insolvency?
Never to my knowledge.
So the exclusive means of the revenue stream for the fund was insurance companies?
Absolutely. The fund, in essence, is a reservoir of money based upon what the insurance carriers pay in. If we'll use Mr. Liska, for example. The moment he, and let's assume it's a 2010 injury, the moment he has the injury, the amputation, there's an automatic $20,000 assessment against society insurance that gets paid into the fund. Heaven forbid Mr. Liska would have got killed in the same, let's set that aside, let's say he got killed and he had no dependents, then you would figure out what the statutory benefit for death benefits is. And let's say he was earning $50,000 a year. The statute says it's four times the yearly wages. Then society insurance, they don't get the benefit by not having any dependents to pay. They would pay $200,000 into the fund.
Well, I suppose one of the reasons why that's an interesting factor here is because of the trial court's holding in regard to the public purpose of potentially being the solvency of the fund. Whether the insurance company pays on the front end or whether they pay on the back end isn't going to, apparently, if I understand it now, with the trial court's holding, in the trial court's view, what difference does it make?
Well, it doesn't make a difference other than...
In terms of the solvency of the fund. The insurance companies apparently are going to pay one way or the other.
They will. And in this case, society gets hit for the whole amount, whereas if it was the fund, every insurance company gets hit a small portion, if you will.
Mr. Goonan, what's your position at this point in regard to a remand so that the record is much more complete in regard to whether or not there's a legitimate public purpose involved here?
I will concede that we did bring up the remand option at the circuit court level. If I learned anything in law school, it was to make more than one argument and make one in the alternative. As far as the remand, I don't think we have to do that. First off, understand that at the department level, at the hearing level, the administrative law judge level, there was an option to take testimony. That option was chosen in the negative, if you will. I admit that both sides, not just the fund, but certainly society insurance, agreed that no testimony was taken. But if by making that decision, it's a strategic decision, and if it proves fatal to the fund, then so be it. As far as the remand, I don't think we need that because I think there is enough in the record. We talk about, first of all, I mentioned the $14,000 in February of 2004 when Mr. Liska filed the hearing application, but there's more dollars beyond that. Judge English at the circuit court level came up with a range of dollars between $5,500 and $12,500 between 2004 and 2007.
For just this person?
Yes, ma'am.
Where did he get that from?
He did kind of his own calculations, and we admit certainly that the record is sparse, and I think one of the functions is that the injury was back in 1982. It's hard to recreate some of the records that may have disappeared over the course of 20-plus years. Back to the $1,500 and the $12,500, that's what Judge English came up with between 2004 and 2007. So that's over and above the $14,000 that Mr. Liska came to the table with. Even if we use a conservative amount, let's use the midpoint, $9,000. That's over the course of 3 years between 2004 and 2007. Mr. Liska, to use round numbers, has a 27-year life expectancy. $3,000 a year or $9,000 every 3 years, you have $81,000 still for Mr. Liska.
Counsel. seems to me that your obligation is to carry the burden of proof. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. Seems to me that if you brought in evidence, you'd bring in a doctor who would say, on the basis of this man's medical records, on the basis of his injury, to a degree of reasonable certainty relating to medical practice, you'd expect in his lifespan to have X amount of medical expenses. Isn't that how you would prove it up?
That's certainly one option. In this case, his injury was in 82. We had already paid, I think, ballpark $67,000 just in medical bills. So I think you can look at the past in addition to your suggestion of having a physician expert.
So you take $67,000 over how many years, 12 years?
The $67,000, Your Honor, would have been from the date of injury through their last payment of 02.
And then how many years was that?
20 years.
20 years. So $70,000, just for simple math, would be $2,000 a year.
For just Mr. Liska, mm-hmm. But this would affect...
I know, I'm just trying to figure out, you're going to use $9,000, why don't we use $2,000? I mean, I'm questioning really whether it makes any sense to average out this or to have reasonable testimony as to what might be the future. The past show $2,000 a year. What I'm trying to raise with you is just what's in the record that would be findings of fact by the trial court that is substantiated by credible evidence.
We have the $5,500 to the $12,500,
which are figures that are not in the record, not proven up by anyone.
Okay, we do have the $14,000 leading into
OR. That we know. Mm-hmm. And was the $67,000 in the record?
$67,000, yes, ma'am. That would be part of the WKC 13, which society is required to file with the Department of Workforce.
I know, but is it in this record?
I believe
so. In the trial court record? Okay. Do you agree as to this proposition of law that even if there's a burden on you to impose liability, that mere imposition of liability doesn't constitute a violation of the Constitution? In other words, that the legislature can burden you retroactively.
They have that right, yes, Your
Honor. They have that right. So we have to do the balance, right?
Correct, either in Martin or in Chappie, depending on whether it's the contract or due process. Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
So your position is that this is a substantial burden on you?
Yes, ma'am.
By looking only at Liska or looking at all the Liskas that might be in your portfolio?
Well, I think certainly just looking at Liska, we don't have the definition of what substantial means. I know in Chappie, de minimis, I think that amount was $1,100. We've exceeded that. But this affects all the insurance carriers.
Right.
So there might be one Liska, two Liskas, or 137 Liskas. We don't know that.
You don't know it in society, and you don't know it in the other insurance companies.
Correct.
So should the court just suppose that there are a lot?
I don't want the court to speculate. We know that there's more than one.
Right.
And again, I don't want to talk about something that's outside the record, mm-hmm. But I think it's fair to presume that there's more than two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think there's a reason we're here today, and I think that's knowing that, just common sense, that Mr. Liska isn't the only one with a traumatic bar claim.
So what do you think the purpose of the state was in imposing liability on you?
Well, without any legislative history, without any record, I have no idea. If Solvency certainly seems to be a reasonable guess, but in Neiman, they talk about that the Martin test, it's not an opinion poll. I don't know what, I mean, we know what the fund's opinion is. I don't know that the opinion matters.
Counselor, you've agreed that we are to interpret the statute as the legislature's effort to enact a retroactive statute, right?
That was their purpose in the language, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And generally, we would try to get around constitutional questions by interpreting it not to be retroactive if there were a substantial burden on one of the parties, correct?
Correct.
And have you taken this position because if you can persuade the court, then the statute's gone altogether and the legislature would have to start over on some kind of a process? In this regard, or why? I don't quite get why you're doing this. The combination confounds me a little bit.
Well, if the court struck the amendment as unconstitutional, I think we could then go prospective forward, saying injuries occurring on April 1, 2006, or forward. It makes it very, very simple for litigants out there to know the specific date. And I think if we want to talk about public policy, it would seem to make more sense that the unlucky insurance carrier, in this case Society, doesn't get hit for the case when their statute of limitations had run in 02. The case was closed. Any good case in litigation is the one that's closed. And go back to the fund, which again is spreading the surcharge or the fees against each and every carrier, as opposed to the one unlucky carrier, Society, that just happened to be the carrier at the time of Mr. Liska's injury.
Right, I understand that, but what I don't understand is if you were to argue to us that, you know, there's no legislative history here and the legislature couldn't have meant this to be retroactive because it would violate a substantive right that Society has created by a statute of limitations which is run before the act ever came into being, that allows us to hold the statute constitutional but get to where you want to go. So I have a problem with, I don't quite understand why we're in the posture we're in. Do you understand what I'm saying? There's a simpler argument that you have chosen not to make, and I'm trying to figure out why. Do you understand what's bugging me?
No.
Okay. Generally, we interpret a statute to be constitutional. Okay, we assume the legislature drafted them in a constitutional fashion. Yet you have agreed with the state that this statute, we are to interpret this statute as being retroactive, and you object to the retroactivity because you say it violates your constitutional rights. Why haven't you argued that we should interpret the statute as being prospective only? Then your constitutional rights fall away, the statute's constitutional, and it's a very simple argument. I just don't get the way it's postured.
Okay. Thank you for explaining the question,
yeah.
Your Honor. We purposely did not make that argument because, one, the statute clearly says the purpose is retroactive, and secondly,
where is it regardless of the time of injury, isn't that the language?
Right.
It
references.
Doesn't say the statute is retroactive. It just says regardless of the time of injury. That's right. Just let me finish. So you're saying that's only allowed to have one possible interpretation?
I believe so, because at reference it says regardless of the date of injury, and the date of injury can go back years and years and years.
Sure.
And if it went back, let's say the date of injury was 1960, a six-year statute of limitation, it would have run in 1966.
Yeah, I understand that, but what you're telling me is that I could never interpret those words as being regardless of the date of injury from the date the statute was passed forward.
I that's not how I read the statute.
Well, that's fine. I mean, you can read it any way you like.
And moreover, the other reason why we thought it was retrospective is that Workers' Compensation Act is deemed remedial. Therefore, that's how the reading, when you combine that, that's how we evaluated the
yeah.
statute.
Okay. Well,
I think that's how the fund evaluates it.
Well, of course, that's how the fund evaluates it. That's a very good argument for them. It's not a very good argument for you. You've got a ways to go with that argument.
Do you want the opportunity to brief that this is not retroactive?
Well, they've given up on that, is my understanding. I just didn't understand why.
Well, we'll take the opportunity if that's a question of the court, and if it's remanded, then certainly that can be another option that's brought up.
Do you think the statute is plain on its face?
I believe so.
And the advisory council minutes would tend to indicate that.
When they purposely used the term date of injury, Your Honor, I think they knew what that meant.
Okay. So we got statute that's retroactive. In Nyman, the court said, merely identifying a substantive or vested property right is not dispositive for determining whether retroactive legislation meets the test of due process. You agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So we've got to find a substantial vested property right, and we've got to find a legislative purpose. Right?
Ma'am.
And you can't find a legislative purpose.
That's before us. No, ma'am. Okay.
And on a vested right, you say it's vested because the statute of limitations has expired.
As of June of 2002. Yes, Your Honor.
And how substantial it is not much in the record to tell us that.
If the definition of substantial is based on numbers, I would agree with that, correct.
Mm-hmm. What else could it be based on?
Well, knowing that it affects the, that it affects the carriers and self-insured employers as a whole.
In this case, the employee gets paid. Employee is protected, right?
There's absolutely no adverse effect against Mr. Liska. He's never appeared from day one.
And sometimes in these cases, whether the employee is affected is put into the hopper of determining whether the statute's valid.
That certainly is a large consideration to
right.
take care of the injured worker, which is the whole purpose of the Work Comp Act. Yes, Your
That's
Honor.
That's right. So that's just out of this case.
Not relevant at all. No, ma'am.
So it's really just a who pays.
It's this chair or that chair, and really that chair is a combination of everyone that's
right.
over here.
Musical chairs.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Counsel, what we've talked about, this is a retroactive application. Workers' comp is remedial. I look at the certain, there's been some discussion about impairment of contract and Court of Appeals and its certification indicates allowing society to calculate its exposure and set premiums accordingly. And my question is this, what, if any, import is it that workers' compensation premiums are set differently than other kinds of insurance policies in the industry, and that they are set based on retroactive experience? As I recall, workers' comp is initially you pay your contract for premium, but it's understood that it's tentative. Your initial premium is based on a certain rate times your payroll or something. And then they look, and then the policy continues to unfold and time passes, and then they look at your experience, claims money, claims paid, and then they go back and they set the initial premium to be paid. So it's a very different animal than auto insurance that I would buy or the CGL that I would buy. What import is there, if any, in terms of contract when the premium is retroactive to a concern that the statute imposes some kind of retroactive change impairment of contract?
Yeah, it's an accurate analysis and explanation of how it works, but I don't see the relevancy, because as soon as the statute runs, we had a vested interest. We knew as a moment of the date of injury how long the statute of limitations would go, but for additional TTD payments or permanency indemnity payments.
But the point is, if you paid out the 14 grand in the year 2000 and whatever year, 2009, then you can your premiums are going to go up and you're going to recoup it through your premiums. Because your premiums are based on what was paid out in your experience. In fact, if your experience is good, you'll even get money back on last year's premiums, which I've had clients do that. So the trial court said you can't recoup your premiums and based his decision on you can't recoup your losses through premiums. But concept that Justice Bradley has just given you says you can.
But only for a period of time.
But it'll be the entire future. So the more you pay out, you're going to get, the more society pays out, the more society can charge premiums.
Correct, but that assumes that society insurance will insure James Meyer from here to, you know, a period of time. And at some point, James Meyer may go shopping and go to the General Casualties or the other carriers of the world. So at some point, I think that's a line that stops. It ceases.
Does James Meyer have to be in business forever?
No.
I mean, they could go out of business.
Absolutely could.
Counsel, just so I understand. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Counsel, just so I understand your argument in regard to the substantial interest, is it my understanding that for in expenses incurred over a 20-year period, society reimbursed Mr. Liska $67,000?
The red light is on. May I believe to answer?
Yes. 1982 to 2002, I think you said?
Between 1982 and 2002, a 20-year time frame, just for medical expenses, it was $67,000. In addition to that, there was temporary total disability and permanent partial disability.
So then, apparently from 2002 to 2004, an additional $14,000 was incurred?
Based upon, the direct answer is yes, and the analysis of that is because James Meyer on his own accord filed a hearing application seeking that amount, that would confirm that. Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so that's about $81,000 over a 22-year period.
Yes, sir.
Which comes out to about $3,500 a year. And I think you said, and I think I saw it in the briefs, that the life expectancy in this particular instance is 27 years.
Correct, Your Honor.
Well, that would 27 years times 3,500 is another $94,000. So if we add the $94,000 to the $14,000, is it a fair characterization that there's about $108,000 that society did not plan for and had no way of knowing it was going to be liable to pay in this one particular case until the legislature changed the statute?
Had no idea. Yes, sir.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
James Friedman, representing the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. I'm James Friedman from Godfrey & Kahn, and we represent the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance as amicus curiae in this case. We'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to appear here today at the argument. Before getting into the substance of my argument, I thought I would try to answer a few questions that were raised in the last 50 minutes or so. First, Chief, when you suggested that we had proposed remand, that didn't strike a bell, and I did look back at my brief quickly, and I don't believe that we did suggest remand. I believe that the record and our position has been that the record is sufficient for the trial court's decision, and we think the trial court should, in fact, be affirmed here. If, in fact, you find a sentence somewhere, at best that would have been an alternative argument, as Mr. Gunin suggested. He made an alternative argument, but that's not our position. I'd like to address Justice Rogensack's point about the language of the statute and why haven't the parties argued that the legislative intent was for this not to be retroactive and in that regard not raise the constitutional questions. As I was reading the record starting in the administrative agency and going forward, I wondered why the parties argued about that, in fact, because I did think that the language that I think the Chief or Justice Bradley pointed out, was pretty clear that the legislature did, in fact, intend for this to apply retroactively. And so it certainly didn't surprise me as I read through the record and got to the Court of Appeals that both sides had essentially given up that argument. And we certainly would agree, although it would be a perfectly fine result if the court were to say the legislature intended for it to not be retroactive. We don't think that's the case here.
Counselor, we don't decide what the legislature intended. We decide what they said. And then we decide what they said, what did that mean? So it's a little bit of a different analysis.
No, I completely agree with that. I just think the language is quite clear. I don't think it's ambiguous in that regard. Finally, Justice Gableman, I think the way the numbers work out, I completely agree with the point that was made at the end about the dollars. I think the dollars were about $67,000 in medical expenses paid out over a 20-year period from the date of injury till the statute ran for society. There was then a four-year period where the fund was responsible, and that number, how much they paid, may be in the record. I'm not familiar with it. And then the $14,000 at issue is between 2006 and 2009. That's really what we're here about, although I assume that that number continues to increase. Because, in fact, Mr. Liska's injuries are of a type that he needs. He will need care probably for the rest of his life. The Wisconsin legislature, of course, has the authority to create, to amend, and to get rid of statutes of limitations with respect to Wisconsin laws. And the WIA takes no position here on the prospective application of Section 102.17 sub 4. The retroactive application of this new legislation, which would, in essence, revive claims that already are time-barred, would take away a vested right from society in violation of the Due Process Clause and impair contracts in violation of the Contract Clause of the state and federal constitutions, and that's the problem with the statute. It's important to note that, as the Chief pointed out, Mr. Liska will be compensated for continuing medical care. The only question before the court is who pays. Will it be the fund or will it be society? As I noted, society paid those expenses until the statute ran. For about 4 years, the fund paid, and now the question is before the court, who should pay since the effective date of the new statute?
Mr. Friedman, suppose the fund had nothing in it. I understood your opposing counsel to say there's no way to get any more money to put in the fund.
I would disagree with that. 2 points. One, there's no evidence in the record that the fund ever has been or is today insolvent. In fact, we took a look online, saw nothing suggesting that the fund isn't functioning as it's intended to function. Second, the fund gets its money by assessing the insurance industry. If it's running out of money, it can assess the insurance industry. If it needs the assessment caps or the way it assesses to change, that's something the legislature can change prospectively to add money to the fund. But this is not a situation where it really can run out of money the way that it is set up. As the court knows, we represent another fund on a regular basis, and that fund, when it's low on money, assesses the same industry.
You're treating this as a statute of limitations case, and the cases hold that if you revive a claim, if you revive a cause of action after the statute has come into play, that is a violation.
Right? Correct, Your Honor.
And that's your position.
That is our position, Chief.
And that's, so you're not into balancing.
I would suggest that the courts, if you let me
yes, you
speak
may
for a minute or so, going back 120 years to the Eingartner case, this court has never found that reviving a statute of limitations that already run did not violate due process. It always has found a due process violation, 120 years of case law. And what I would suggest is the language that you mentioned from Nyman says that, you know what, even if you're talking about a vested right being taken away, maybe you apply the balance anyways. I would note, though, that Nyman came out finding the statute unconstitutional as retroactively applied. So I don't think you'll find a case reviving a statute of limitations or creating a new cause of action or expanding one as a Nyman, a higher damage cap, where this court hasn't said you can't apply that retroactively.
And here's my problem with that argument. This is not quite the usual statute of limitations. It's just a very different kind of animal. Now, maybe you disagree with that, so you can tell me why.
Chief, you'll note in our brief we focus more on the balancing test than on kind of an absolute rule, partly because of the language in Nyman and partly because it's a little different. It's not is the claim gone, it's who pays at
right.
the end.
Right.
And we acknowledge that, and that's one of the reasons we didn't hammer home kind of the absolute rule. And that said, I don't think it matters whether you apply an absolute rule or whether you apply the balancing test, and that both counsel have argued about that, but society's rights are clearly substantially impaired here. We're talking about $14,000, and it's probably more than that due immediately. The judge just in his head did a little math and said it's going to be at least 80 by the time Mr. Liska passes away. That's substantial. When you add in, as the court did in Noel, looked at the rest of the industry and how that was going to have an impact, clearly it's substantial. There might not be a lot of claims out there, but these are big claims. These are claims where the medical expenses continued for 12 years after the last non-medical payment or after the last claim. These are all big claims. If there's a dozen of them, you might get to $1 million very easily. That's substantial. On the flip side, there's no public policy supporting retroactive application. The legislature didn't identify any. The parties really didn't. The fund can assess the industry to get more money if it needs to. There simply is no evidence on the other side of the balance. For those two reasons, we'd suggest the court affirm.
I worry about future cases, too, and I'm sure you do, too. And it strikes me that you got a problem where the court writes an opinion that says, well, $14,000, and then you can decide that he's got a 27-year life expectancy and multiply it out, make up all these numbers, and then you got all these other insurance companies and multiply it all out. Just strikes me where there's a presumption of constitutionality and the burden of proof is on society, and you got some hesitancy whenever it's retroactive. The court gets a little nervous. Maybe the presumption isn't so good. But should we really be saying, hey, you don't have to prove it, the court can guess at it?
The answer is no, and I don't think you have to guess here. In terms of a substantial impairment of rights, one, I would suggest that society has lost a vested right in this claim being gone, being off its books, number one. Number two, we know it's at least $14,000. That's not a de minimis amount. If James Meyer was self-insured and was and I don't know the size of James Meyer Incorporated, but if it was a two- or three-person shop, you know, $14,000 might be the difference between solvency and not. That's substantial by itself. That's in the record. That's undisputed. That's on one side. There's nothing on the other side. And as you said, Chief, when it's retroactive, the court should be suspicious. When it's the state retroactively impairing contracts, you should be more suspicious. You add that together, I don't think you need to remand. I think there's enough in the record here to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman.
Thank you.
Mr. Hart, I should tell you that Justice Bradley will listen to the remaining parts of the argument on tape.
Yes,
she had to leave. Nothing personal to anybody involved.
I know that Justice Bradley likes me.
Okay.
I have 2 points on rebuttal, Your Honors. First, Attorney Guggen indicates that the fund is a pool, a reservoir of money, and counsel indicated that we can simply raise rates or assessments on insurers. Now, first of all, the fund is not a reservoir or pool of money. It is money that it's a pool, it's a fund that if it's depleted, you know, there's no more money for injured workers, there's no more money for widows or orphans, and those people aren't being taken care of by the insurance companies. Those rights aren't being protected or guarded by the current system, as the insurance company points out. Now I want to back up to counsel's point briefly that we can raise the assessments. Larson 9103 sub 8 points out that when you have large assessments on workers' comp insurance providers, that it discourages business between the borders of the state. So in essence, what Larson points out, and this court can take judicial notice of that treatise, is that when we raise rates when we raise assessments too high on insurance companies for workers' compensation insurance or these assessments paid into the fund, it discourages business from coming here and setting up shop here. So we can't, for that reason alone, we can't raise rates the way that council has pointed out.
Does the fund have the ability to raise rates without legislative enactment?
No, it does not.
Legislative enactment?
Yes, Your Honor. That's my understanding, it is. There are a number of procedural hurdles that the fund has to jump, in addition to a lot of other business concerns that the fund has to consider when they're raising the assessments. The private insurance companies can simply raise rates, and each of them can take a small piece of this hit that we're talking about in the case at bar. Secondly, as the court pointed out, and I'll close on this, that Society Insurance had the burden to prove that there was a substantial impairment in this case, that they would be substantially impaired by the case at bar and by the $14,000. And no matter how you do the calculations or what the projections are of Mr. Liska's life expectancy, they have not illustrated that this is a substantial impairment to their interests. In addition, there has been nothing pointed out today or by them in the record that indicates that the fund's stated purpose in its brief, that the maintenance of the fund and the security of the fund is not a legitimate purpose, simply because there has been no evidence that the fund is insolvent today doesn't mean that protection of the fund isn't an interest that we should be that's not legitimate, that the court shouldn't be considering, and that we shouldn't be forwarding. I know that counsel pointed out that that they've looked on the internet and that their check on the internet indicated that that the fund was not in any way insolvent. If we're going to look on the internet and bring things in that aren't in the record, the last check of the internet that we did indicated that the insurance industry in Wisconsin alone took in $1.75 billion of insurance premiums. We simply can't raise that kind of funds even if we tried. So the insurance company are in the best position to pass these costs along to the consumers. The fund's not. And for those reasons, we ask that you reverse the circuit court's decision and affirm the commission's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank Attorneys Hart and Goonan and Friedman for their arguments today in a state constitutional issue regarding workers' comp and retroactive legislation. Difficult issues and certified to this court. And this concludes our hearing on 08-AP-3135, Society Insurance versus Lurk. And if the students would remain, Justice Crooks will be out shortly and discuss this. The court will be in recess until 1:30.